Welcome back, everybody, to the Wall Street Coach podcast. My name is Kim Ann Curtin, and I'm very excited to have Maggie Jackson here today. She is the author of my new favorite nonfiction book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Here is my Kindle version. This is a book I'm going to have to buy, Maggie, because I can't just have this one on my Kindle. Thank you for coming to my podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been just an incredible journey with your book for the past month. I was in the middle of devouring it when I had to read another book. And I was so, remorseful because I didn't want to put yours down. But it has been such a profound book for me, I feel, because I do like to be certain. I do like to be sure. And yet I also am a very curious person. So your book has sort of, kind of given me permission, if you will, to embrace more of my curiosity and to not be so worried about being unsure. So just thank you for that gift.
Oh, you're welcome. I think we all have those tensions within us. We want to be sure. We want the answers. But on the other hand, we also, I think most people actually like being curious and being open-minded. So we can explore all of those tensions and possibilities, definitely.
I would love to. And one thing I do kind of speak to is that I had a very important business conversation, and I have two very good, well-trusted advisors who had given me slightly different perspectives on how to handle it. And I, really was wrestling with both of these directions the night before the conversation, and I couldn't nail down which one I was going to take into that conversation, which was unusual for me. And then, because I was in the throes of your book, I thought, wait a minute, maybe I can go into this conversation uncertain. And I did, and it was exactly what I needed, because it facilitated. I knew which one I was going to pull out, but I had to hear what was going on for that other person on the other negotiational side. And that facilitated me showing up, I have no doubt, very different. So thank you for that too.
Oh, that's wonderful. And in fact, studies show that people can be highly tolerant of uncertainty and yet be assertive. So actually you can, people who are highly tolerant of ambiguity and et cetera are not meek. They're actually, have strong convictions, but yet they can be open to moving forward amidst their uncertainty or amidst the ambiguity. So that's a great story that really perfectly illustrates that. Yes.
It was just so powerful. And it just, I remembered the emotions I was feeling in the wrestling. I was mad at myself. I was frustrated with myself. And then it was like the clouds lifted, and that shaming of being uncertain just dissipated. And I was like, that is the power of what this book can do. It gives you a paradigm shift, that being in that place of uncertainty is nothing to be embarrassed about.
Right. Truly, I think that's one of the main messages of my book, and you've put it so well. I think that basically, oftentimes, it's the fear of the unknown or not knowing that actually sets us back, rather than the state of not knowing itself. Yeah. And what I'm arguing in brief is that uncertainty is a space of possibilities. There's a lot more to it than that, but just for starters, it is the ability to maybe pause or slow down or leave things open and then investigate and be curious and be open-minded. And so it's not the weakness comes from our erroneous assumptions about what uncertainty will do. Because I think we live in this incredibly efficiency-oriented, outcome-oriented society that almost doesn't allow us to have a process of thinking, the process of thinking. So in other words, uncertainty opens up the space between question and answer. And this is not something that you need to do all the time. And most of life is routine and predictable, and we know just what to do. That's what heuristics are, that kind of shortcut thinking that Daniel Kahneman made so famous in his book, Fast and Slow Thinking. That's really great when life is, as scientists say, benign. You know that your driveway hasn't moved when you get home at night, or you know usually the commute is pretty autopilot and you can think of something else on the way home. But when those situations, when you get that unexpected memo or the notice that your client is unhappy or something pops up even in the middle of a conversation, that's when being uncertain is actually a cognitive signal that you need to drop the routine, that you need to drop the autopilot. So actually, it's really fascinating because just to back up even a further step, when people are uncertain, when something's new and unexpected, that unease is a stress response. It's not a signal that we should run away from uncertainty. It's not necessarily even a signal of danger. It's a stress response. So, you know, the hormones and the neurotransmitters flood our body and brain and actually are waking us up to the fact that we need to update our view of the world. Something's changed, you know, get on your toes.
Pay attention.
And then the stress hormones and transmitters are actually linked to better working memory and to higher focus and attention. Scientists call this curious eyes, and to the brain becoming more receptive to new data. So all of this sort of, I call it wakefulness, and scientists call it arousal. That's the discomfort of uncertainty. And it's not something to retreat from. It's something to move forward into. There's a lot we can do about that. You know, it's not just an automatic response. We can lean into uncertainty by recognizing it as good stress. And then one of the cardinal rules of productive uncertainty is making sure, and it sounds really simple, but making sure that you expect the world to change. Because sometimes we might walk into the Monday morning meeting and we think, oh, it'll be just more of the blah, blah, blah. That is, you know, basically a signal to your mind that you're don't have to pick up on your uncertainty, or you don't have to pick up on change or nuance in the room. Studies show that people who are in dynamic environments who overly predict that there won't be change are actually hobbling themselves to, you know, be adaptive. What I'm talking about is adapting. So it's really important.
And the audience, you know, I primarily have are traders, some investors, but traders are constantly in the midst of market fluctuations. And I believe that part of why I feel this book is going to, I literally spent, you know, a half hour emailing over 20 past clients, colleagues, and friends who are traders, because I was like, this book is going to help you become a better trader. Because I do think even for traders who have a particular strategy, who have a particular way of interacting with the market, can at times be lulled into familiarity and comfort. And those moments when the market does not do what it expects, that what that person expects it to do, even under certain circumstances, puts them at a disadvantage if they aren't emotionally prepared for it.
Yes, and exactly. What we're talking about basically is uncertainty as a way to transition out of autopilot. Uncertainty, that unease, et cetera. And there are other studies that are applicable to your audience of traders, because people who work in high pressure situations, have been studied. And for instance, I just read a recent study about doctors, and they were interviewed about the sticky moments during their day, the day when they were unsure, the times when they were unsure during the day, and the doctors. Unease, uncertainty, that uneasy feeling of uncertainty was actually correlated with that heightened attention. It was correlated with actually looking ahead to muster new resources to cope with the situation. So, your mind is on its toes, and you're starting to look ahead. You're starting to look around you, and that's really important. Another study, which was really amazing, award-winning study of top CEOs in the middle of a crisis, not a afternoon's crisis, but sort of a long-term change in the European Union market, a big, you know, big crisis. The CEOs who were most ambivalent about what was happening around them, you know, they didn't make up their mind, hey, this is good, hey, that's bad. No, they were actually wondering, is it good, is it bad? They were the ones who are more resourceful, more inventive. And so that heartens back to that connects with that point I made a bit ago about uncertainty being a space of possibilities. Because if you shut down on the answer, especially prematurely, and especially in a new complex situation, then your options are one. your options are narrowed. Your mind is shut down. And that's really correlated with, often mistaken judgment and just making errors. It's very correlated with making errors.
That's a part where the Dr. Multan said that she said most surgeons will say that the errors or the unexpected happens in their bread and butter cases. That was in your book. And I thought, that is powerful. Who would think that?
Oh, well, exactly. I mean, in the book, I did a lot of research on what expertise is. And that's a really important question today. What does it mean to be an expert in this time of instant information and constant hurry and et cetera, et cetera? So who is the expert? And I went to Toronto to watch surgeons operate. And you were citing one of the surgeons who studies these issues. But I was looking at a surgeon. I was in the operating room right near a liver surgery. And the surgeon was, all efficiency, all exactly what we expect an expert to be, whether it's our accountant or our investment advisor or, the car mechanic. The image of the expert is the person who's most has the instant answer. But again, those kind of experts are called routine experts. They're the ones who, because they have the answers built up from seeing the problems before, they can give an instant answer, just like you were saying, the traders with the strategies. But it's that though, actually, years of experience are correlated only weakly or not at all with skill and accuracy. So as time goes by, if you're a routine expert, you begin to fail in novel new situations because you're just doing this, you're applying the same old knowledge. What's really striking is that something called the adaptive expert is the person who knows when to, as the surgeon Caroline Moulton said, slow down when you should, or, she calls it being in charge of the moment, which I think is a wonderful term, to be in charge of the moment. When something is new, when something goes wrong, you want to be in charge of the moment. You don't want to just apply the same old knowledge. And those adaptive experts actually spend more time assessing a complex problem than even novices do. That's true in finance, that's true in sports, that's true in medicine. And I'm not talking about hours, cogitating. Yeah. These are high pressure jobs. I'm talking about, exactly as in trading, spending a couple minutes just saying, oh, something's different. This is murky. This is new to me. I'm going to just spend a couple minutes inhabiting the question.
Yes, yes. And you talked, and I'm looking here in my 47 pages of notes because I took over 240 highlights from your book, the most I've ever printed out of Kindle book. You talk about these hedge words, the importance of maybe, possibly, somewhat, and how we infrequently use them and how powerful they can be.
Yes, and I think that's a great connection to the social side of uncertainty, mm-hmm. because we need uncertainty when we're thinking. It makes us a better thinker. Again, when times when we meet a new situation, but we also need to have a social collective uncertainty. We mm-hmm. need to sort of share our uncertainty. So that speaks to there are studies out of Harvard that show that using the words maybe or sometimes are actually correlated with the other people on the team or other people in a negotiation, even seeing you as more professional and as a more effective leader. So that's counter to what we might assume. You think the word maybe is a sign of weakness. It actually does two things. Linguistically speaking, if you use the word maybe, it actually signals that you're receptive to another person's point of view, which is, you know, definitely makes you stronger. Yeah. And then secondly, it also is a signal that there's something more to know. You know, maybe it opens up the door to everybody unearthing new information. And again, what could be more important when you're trying to be inventive or you're trying to get the best solution, not just the first, any old solution. Yes. It's really important. Hedge words are our ally, not something to shun. And the opposite of hedge words are words like therefore, or, you know, you're wrong, you know, things that really shut down the equation. So
absolutely.
Yeah. It's really important. And,
go ahead. You keep
going. Oh, I said, you know, a CEO reached out to me and he had an incredible story where he had been with in, you know, he had worked in General Electric in the heyday, Jack Welch days. And then he wanted to sort of, he came in to rescue a company, a manufacturing company in Rhode Island. And he actually found that the company, his first impression was, this company that makes plastics of some kind is really good at fixing things. Wow. In the first 6 months, he was really amazed. Well, then he found that all the same problems that had led them into bankruptcy were still there because they kept fixing things, but they didn't understand the root of the problem. And so then he said, well, we're going to actually work toward resilience, not toward profit, which is a pretty courageous thing to do in the middle of bankruptcy. And basically, he wound up, you know, waving my book around at the annual conference of the Manufacturing Leadership Council, that, you know, the prime manufacturers of, because basically that's what the adaptable expert does, the adaptable leader does. They're working toward resilience, not goals that are may or may not achieve. And they're also working to understand the problem, the roots of the problem before they rush into solutions.
Yeah. Yeah. That willingness to look at the whole picture. You know, one of the quotes that kept coming to me, it's one of my favorite quotes by Rumi that says, beyond the ideas of right and wrong, there's a field, I'll meet you there. And I thought that is what your book is advocating, is that field beyond right and wrong, really.
Exactly, both for yourself again, and for working with other people. Yep. Another surprise in my research was that actually uncertainty and disagreement are the way forward to good collaboration. Mm-hmm. Now, wow, that seems completely like a crazy thought in this day and age when we don't want more conflict, but actually the research shows we should have productive disagreement and productive uncertainty. And so what does that mean? Well, it basically means that when groups or even a couple of people are getting together to talk about a work problem, very often we as humans love agreement, but, you know, agreement in brief is, as one scientist says, lazy information processing. When a group is in agreement, they stop discussing things deeply. They get less creative. They get more inaccurate. They're kind of sliding around on, I call it the love seat of accord. But when you introduce judicious, you know, respectful conflict, basically the airing of differences, when people are able to say, I don't know, I don't understand, that actually works to unearth the uncertainty, what people don't know. And that, how do we know that it's uncertainty that's the sparkling fuel of good collaboration? Because even if someone is wrong, even if they have a dissenting opinion that's wrong, they basically, the good performance gains are made anyhow. And I tell the story in the book about this law firm in which they were all going to flexible work, and it was a utility company, legal department, and they were all ready to roll out remote work. This is a few years ago. And one of the executives at the very last minute stood up and said, we can't do that. We should not do that because we won't have that kind of serendipitous conversation around the water cooler in the morning. Well, he was right, but he was also wrong because, you know, flexible work is important and remote work is important. And so when he dissented, he was wrong, but he actually, he inspired a younger colleague to stand up and say, oh, I can create a wiki for that. So that's how this good consent, he suddenly jolted everyone onto what I call uncommon ground, you know, and when everyone's in agreement, they're kind of certain and it doesn't help. But when people are in disagreement, they're actually, you know, they're coming together to be more than the sum of their remarkable parts, not less. And this is true in space exploration, in trading. There was a great, fantastic study with traders, actual people who are traders and people with backgrounds in economics. And it said that, you know, just a very small glimpse of, you know, people who were ethnically like alike, you know, kind of inspired people to be more in agreement. Whereas if people spotted difference in this trading experiment, they actually moved into more accurate trading, less alignment. They made more money, and it was a really amazing study.
Study was incredible. And I can see that because so much of Twitter, FinTwit, is, you know, it can kind of become an echo chamber. And there are trading communities and trading, you know, tribes or rooms, Discord rooms, where I have no doubt a lot of times it will feel like consensus. But I think part of what your book really showed me was that can move you towards complacency. Probably better to be sure you have people who are looking at the market different than you who are going to make you question, is that really true? Could I be incorrect? Which I think possibly makes you see things that are going to be a curveball much quicker.
Yes, exactly. That's really, really important to do that. And basically, it's really interesting also because when two people, they're just begun to be discovered, the neural workings of agreement and disagreement. And what's really fascinating is when people are in agreement, they use different parts of their brain that are more related to kind of sensory processing. It's really sort of easy street for the brain. When people are disagreeing, the brain is more energized, one neuroscientist told me. It's more energized. And in fact, later on, I found research that shows that teams in workplaces who are having more disagreement, they learn more from each other and they feel more energized, which exactly reflects the brain research. It was fascinating. Wow. I mean, just fascinating. And some of the things we can do to kind of, And the last important point is that groups that are in disagreement tend to think they're doing better than they are because it's smooth. Yeah. It's smooth. It's easy to be in agreement. Believe it or not, it's actually easier. I mean, you wouldn't think it in this day and age, but it's true, especially when you're working with people. But it's a little harder to have that friction. And yet the outcome is so valuable. It's really worth pushing toward that.
There is a quote at the beginning here that says, faced with a glimpse of challenge or question, we want to ask ourselves, do we rush to seize an answer or do we actually slow down to wonder, to consider, to explore? So I'm just curious for your own journey. You're a journalist, you're a writer. What did this research do for you personally with the work that you do? How did it change you?
Yes, no, that is such a great question. And it did. It radically changed my life. Well, to speak to my work, you know, I do a lot of research and then I go out into the field and I observe and witness. And, you know, I'm in AI robotics labs. I'm in the operating room. I'm, you know, in a sleep lab at Harvard. I'm all over the place when I'm writing a book of this kind of depth and a large topic. This is the third topic I've written about, aspects of humanity that are gravely misunderstood. The first was about home. The second was about attention and now uncertainty. But I know that research and learning is frustrating. You know, we all kind of know that. But what this book did was allow me to realize that that's just normal, that I didn't have to criticize myself or feel, you know, you want to finish the book, you want to finish the deal, you want to finish the trade. Sure. You don't want to hang out in certainty. That's never the end goal.
Right.
But it did liberate me to realize that some uncertainty or even just sleeping on a problem was very, very important for the result, that I got a better result by allowing myself to be uncertain. And one of the specific things that I learned in this book is how important pausing is. And I'm not saying pausing to look at the problem from a different angle. That's a form of deliberation. That's what adaptive experts do. They look at more options, they test them, et cetera. I'm talking about pausing to do nothing. That is very important too. That's
talk
a different-
about that. That's in my list of questions. That's such a powerful part.
Yes. Now, if I do a very difficult interview with a neuroscientist or I read a scientific paper, I now pause before picking up something else, a different paper or picking up the phone. I pause for a few minutes. Well, the reason is this seems like nothingness. It's just letting your mind drift, but that's actually been proven to bolster your memory for what you just learned extraordinarily well. In one experiment, scientists had people read simple passages of prose, and then half of the people who were participating just went to a video game as a kind of break. The other half just did nothing. They literally didn't think of the problem. They didn't think of what they were trying to learn, etc. And they actually, the ones who had done nothing, had better memory for that content, had 20 to 25% better memory, which is a lot. This was true even with people with Alzheimer's, which is stunning. But there's more to the story than just being able to regurgitate that learning later, you know, just the memory itself. Because what's happening when you're enabling your brain to kind of digest and catch up experience is that your brain is actually curating the knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now scientists know that this time of resting, pausing, napping, sleeping, what I call fallow time, is actually a highly active brain state. It's not doing nothing. In fact, actually these brain states, the brain states of rest, are more active than when we're deliberately doing something. Your brain is more active in the silence between movements in a symphony than when you're listening to the symphony. That's amazing. So what your brain is doing is kind of sifting and curating, and your hippocampus, the repository of the first memories, you know, say you just learned some new rules out of the SEC or something like that. You now have that knowledge. It's sort of a kind of a rough memory in your hippocampus. Your hippocampus begins to tag that memory with the time, the place, the situation, so that it can then kind of insert the memories into the rest of your brain, your cortex, in a way that makes sense. So that's why we have memories that are kind of related, and our knowledge is like a network thing. And so you're really allowing your brain to catch up with your experience. If we're constantly just expecting the brain to be like a Xerox machine, okay, we encoded the memory and now we upload it. That's not how it works at all. It's really, and the final frontier is basically to your memories. Your brain is abstracting and gaining gist. That kind of insight that you might get when you wake up after you're thinking of a problem at night, that's gist, or that's abstraction. You're pulling out what's essential across different pieces of knowledge. And that's something that really happens when you're doing nothing at all. It's phenomenal.
Am I correct? There was, you spoke to it being 6 minutes at a minimum that we give ourselves after we've learned something new to let that, you know, kind of digest.
Yes, well, that's the ballpark. I mean, studies are never the last word, but yeah. That's, yes, that particularly you know, that particular study that made headlines, I think it was about 6 minutes. I'd say even if you have 3 minutes to spare, it'll help. It really will help. And doing nothing is now something that I incorporate into my day. Again, not all the time, but it's a fuel. It's a rocket booster for your mind.
Yeah. The other study that was just so profound for me was, you know, that I too, like this gal Celeste Kidd, was depressed after that marshmallow challenge video that, of course, we've all seen, where the kid, you know, doesn't have the ability to wait it out. And yet how you speak to Celeste's research and others who speak to how, you know, there's no doubt that there are a lot of traders who do come from traumatic backgrounds, volatile backgrounds. And I think a lot of attachment style too sometimes is, you know, avoidant or anxious. And I think that's part of the draw to trading, you know, that excitement, that volatility. And so I just loved that, you know, new approach and looking at that research that, you know, who, as a kid who's in a volatile situation, who never knows where their, let's say, next meal or a roof is coming from, they're going to eat that marshmallow quick because they know it won't be there. It was just such an incredible perspective shift. So would you be willing to talk a little bit about that part of the book? Because I think it was so important.
Sure. Yes. Yes. I think that so often in school and in the rest of the society, we often have a very narrow idea of what skills are needed. And yes, we of course need sustained focus, and we of course need the time to reflect and et cetera. You know, you need to maybe take the SATs, but what's been lost over time in studying, you know, kids is often the skills that arise from precarious situations, as you were saying, unpredictable situations. And we can kind of see that, you know, this is what Charles Dickens had. You know, he came from a very poor, difficult background, and he was such an observer of society. He was so sensitive to and attuned to societal change. And then Jesse Owens and even Sonia Sotomayor, you know, the Supreme Court judges, these are all examples of people with basically street smarts. Yeah. And so that is, you know, these kind of hidden talents that emerge in unpredictable situations are now gaining attention. And it's really important that this is often related when kids are growing up and they don't know, and there's not a tremendous amount of stability, they become highly attuned to their our surroundings. They become very, very nimble and adaptable to what's going on. They also have better working memory. This, of course, is echoing what I said at the beginning about the wakefulness of uncertainty. They have it in spades. Now, of course, you know, there's a caveat here. Yes. No one should have to exist without knowing where their next meal comes from, because there are two main limitations to uncertainty. First of all, you don't want it to last forever. It's not the end goal. It's a vehicle for getting the better answer. But also, we should never have to, you know, we're not working toward, or no one would ever want uncertainty in survival modes. Right. You know, so you don't want uncertainty in the house, you know, where you live or what you're eating or something like that. But, you know, when you are, you know, when you have some, you know, basically when you're able to survive, then these types of, you know, attunement and observation and skills that arise from uncertainty are something that we can learn from. It's really important. And the marshmallow experiment that you were talking about is a great illustration of that. This researcher gave kids a series of experiments where they were told that, you know, they could draw a picture and then they could use these old beat up crayons now, or she would return with great crayons if they waited. It was like waiting for the marshmallow. Well, she came back and she said, "I don't have any new crayons, but you can just use these." And then the second time it was stickers or something. Well, after about the second time, all kids, you know, whether or not they'd been raised in predictable situations, all kids were just going with the first reward, you know, forget waiting, because waiting isn't working when the world is breaking its promises. And so I think we can really learn from this. You know, now we're seeing High volatility everywhere, whether it's stock markets or geopolitics or weather patterns, et cetera. And that's one kind of uncertainty. Yeah. But uncertainty out there, you know, we cannot know whether the snowstorm or the hurricane or the monsoon will actually drop, you know, or, you know, do something to our coastal region, et cetera. We can't know. We can only get a toehold on the likelihood, an estimate based on probabilistic modeling, et cetera. That's what we can't know. The world will not, you know, give us all the answers, but what we can control and what I'm writing about is our response to the unknown. That's the second kind of uncertainty. That's called epistemic uncertainty. And so the human response to the unknown starts with recognizing the limits of your knowledge. And that's a really important, you know, difference to make. So everything that I'm talking about means that we can really learn from people who were raised in unpredictable situations as we, you know, go further and further into a rather unpredictable world. What I'm talking about is having different tools in your toolbox to deal with uncertainty, you know, rather than just denying it or retreating from it or fearing it. I think we can learn to skillfully deal with uncertainty. That's what the book is all about. Productive uncertainty.
Embracing it because it's not going anywhere.
Right, exactly. And I think of it as almost like a second skin. You know, when the world is in the unpredictable moment or unpredictable year, what have you, if you are, first of all, trying to hope for predictability that isn't there, well, you're out of touch with reality. But also if you retreat from it or deny it, then you're, again, out of touch with reality. But when you are open to the uncertainty, and then you can both explore your own inner uncertainty and what's going on out there, then you are, you know, you're kind of like the surfer catching the wave of life. When you can deal with uncertainty, you can deal with life itself. And that's why it's actually linked very strongly to resilience. People who are really good at contending with uncertainty tend to be flexible thinkers. They tend to be curious. They tend to be resilient and more psychologically healthy, which is really important right now. Very. With all the anxiety we see.
So much so. And it makes me feel for, you know, the listeners here that people, you know, we of course have sophisticated traders here, but there are beginners as well. And part of me, you know, there's obviously no bar of entry to becoming a trader, but I want to say to anybody listening, if you consider yourself to be a person comfortable with uncertainty, then it's likely you will not be able to make it as a trader because you will not have that comfort with the discomfort and or be resilient enough, which is
yes.
critical.
And it goes back exactly to what I was saying about what holds us back is the fear of not knowing or the unknown rather than the condition itself. And people tell me again and again that learning to be skillful and tolerant of uncertainty is liberating. People tell me it's actually makes them more courageous. Doctors in a study in Maine who were taught tolerance of ambiguity were more courageous. Now, courage and uncertainty, wow, that doesn't seem like it should go together. But when you can realize that you can consider and then reconsider, or you can invest, you can see like the CEOs who were ambivalent when the European markets were expanding, they waded in and their ambivalence allowed them to be more able to see the possibilities. They were courageous. They felt courage. And that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel so much of perhaps technology has moved us into this kind of cultural rigid expectation of the world, of ourselves, because that is so at our fingertips, as if we all have to know, as if we all, you know, I see this on Twitter all the time, like, here is the top 10 things you have to do or have to achieve or have to be sure you do know. And it's just, this certainty is just madness. And you're just like, really?
No, exactly.
You are so damn certain. How can you all be certain?
Yeah, no, I, well, you said it so well. I think that you're exactly right. I mean, even the look and feel of technology, it's all about bullet points and neat little boxes. And then, of course, most of all, it's about instant answers. And we probably all know the statistic that when you do a Google search, most people, first of all, never look at the second page of search results. Then, first of all, they usually take the first answer that Google gives them. And what's interesting is that I was in contact for this book with the head of Google search at Google. And he was talking about how Google doesn't admit that it doesn't know. It doesn't. So you're only seeing, it's kind of like the person looking for their keys under the lamppost. Yes. You know, they're not looking at the dark. We don't know all that we don't see with knowledge. And of course, you can't know, but you can at least at any given moment know that you might not know everything, and that strengthens your thinking right now. There was study after study I came across, and even a brief search online leaves people feeling they know more than they do, so they can't gain a kind of hubris. That's really dangerous, because learning is all about knowing what you don't know, so then you can pursue that weakness or insufficiency. There are studies after studies that show that this technology does affect us. It makes us, and in fact, some evidence shows that actually the technology is helping boost intolerance of uncertainty. So fear of the unknown might be, being bolstered by having the technology. There's one thing that's really interesting, and I think it's interesting for us all, even if we're not clinically anxious, or even if we're not, suffering from mental challenges, which so many of us do. Now psychologists are doing actual treatments for many, many mental disorders, everything from PTSD to eating disorders to anxiety and depression. They are treating these disorders just by focusing on intolerance of uncertainty, because intolerance of uncertainty is now seen as the kind of underlying vulnerability factor for disorders. So if people can do kind of simple little steps, it's sort of based on exposure therapy, but if they can do simple little steps to become a little bit, no, I mean, we're not talking about, if I'm kind of not the person who likes to go bungee jumping or, jump out of a plane. We're not talking about making people do that. We're talking about simple steps such as, hey, order a new dish at a restaurant, or delegate more at work, kind of cede control a little bit. You don't know what'll happen, but chances are it's not the disaster you fear. And that kind of simple training is correlated with, as I mentioned, higher resilience, less worry, less depression, and it's being used to treat the most intractable, difficult cases of anxiety. It's pretty stunning. And so that's something we can all take a lesson for. This is not complicated stuff, but it's actually harder to do than you think. When I think about, try a new dish at a restaurant, I'm actually really love on a Friday night to go to the same old restaurant and order the same old clam spaghetti. And that's what I like about a Friday night. And so I said, I thought to myself, you can do a little better about that. Order the crazy appetizer that you, didn't think you, and you'll do that. If you do that, you're actually stretching yourself, but incrementally, because that's another really important point about uncertainty. Uncertainty is actually good. Productive uncertainty is edge work. It's working at the edge of what you know, and that's where human beings thrive. Some people call stretching themselves. Some people call it getting out of their comfort zone. But that's exactly what uncertainty allows us to do, which is very exciting.
That beautiful ceramicist sculptor talks so beautifully about it is in his not knowing what he's about to do with his sculpture or pottery, that he said, the artistic genius will come forth. I thought that was such an incredible interview with him. That's in your book.
Exactly. And that he was actually talking about the way his particular media forces him to kind of sometimes put things aside. You have to let the clay dry. You have to fire it up. You just have to, you know, so it's a kind of a stop and start, off and on sort of type of art. But he finds that when he goes back to see what he'd been doing and it, you know, he took a break from it, he's actually seeing it new. And so that's another, you know, reiteration or underscoring of how if you just, you don't have to barrel through the problem that night and get it all done. My husband's a little bit like that. You know, when he starts a project, like he does home woodworking and he just wants to do it all on a weekend and he wants to get it done. And then you've got this rickety bookshelf. Well, maybe if he spaced it over a few weekends and then was able to see where the weakness are, you know, step by step. I think that's another thing that was really liberating for me about this research is I realized that when I'm coming and going sometimes from a topic or setting things aside, it's really important. In that way, you come back at it with fresh eyes. Yeah. Very important.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I hope that you will allow me to read your other book, Distracted, Reclaiming Our Focus in a World of Lost Attention, and have you back on my podcast. I just bought that one, so I can't wait to dive into it. Your book is game-changing for work and for the relationship we have with ourselves. Maggie, thank you so much for it. So powerful.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So good. So good. All right, guys, we'll see you soon on another episode of the Wall Street Coach Podcast. Thank you for listening.